A very warm welcome from Invest Africa to all our fantastic members and guests. I'm Chantal Carrington, newly appointed CEO of Invest Africa, albeit a long-standing member from the PwC side. On this particular webinar, I feel that it is only right to refer to the weather, as I vividly remember how I left South Africa, my home country, in March 2007, when it was a scorching 32 degrees, and I landed in the UK the next day, when it was a freezing minus two. And I think it's fair to say that not much has changed in the weather since then. So let's move on to things that are looking to change. I'm delighted to present to you today's Invest Africa 2024 Outlook for Southern Africa, the third webinar in our series of six over the next few weeks, including West, North, East, Francophone, and Lusophone Africa. I've coincidentally just joined from a roundtable on infrastructure and sustainability for South Africa, the third largest Africa country by GDP. So I'm interested to hear from our excellent panel on quite a number of areas, like how we should be looking at investments and financing for Southern Africa in the near and the longer term, and what the impact of the various elections are going to be. Today, we have Deepa Velap from Hogan Lovells, partner in corporate and finance, who is moderating, and she'll be joined by Jeff from APSA, and Yair from Oxford Economics. Just a quick reminder that we will always have the opportunity for Q&A towards the end of the webinar, so please do submit your points of interest. So over to you, Deepa. Thank you.
Thank you, Chantel. Let me start by introducing our main speakers today. So Yair van der Linde is a senior economist at Oxford Economics Africa. He began his career at COF CEO International and also worked for Alan Gray. He's responsible for the macroeconomic analysis of South Africa, while his insight extends to the broader Southern African region, for which he's received recognition from Focus Economics by way of several forecast awards. And Gia holds also a master's degree in risk management. Our second speaker is Jeff Gable. Jeff Gable is a managing principal, head of FIC research, and chief economist for APSA Group. His research teams cover fundamental macroeconomic and market strategy research on South Africa and across numerous sub-Saharan markets. Jeff also joined the South African business from Barclays in late 2006 as part of the build-out for the investment bank. In his 25 years as a professional economist, Jeff's career also spans Deutsche Bank in London, the International Monetary Fund in Washington, D.C., and the Canadian Central Bank. Jeff studied economics at the University of Western Ontario and Queen University, Canada. Well, welcome, Jeff, and welcome, Gia. I hope that we're going to have a riveting discussion. I'm going to be posing some questions, hopefully not too difficult. And then obviously we will look at the Q&A towards the end of the session and engage with some of the questions from our audience. So perhaps if I can start with you, Jeff. The first question, which is probably top of mind for all of us in South Africa at the moment, is that the spotlight on the next election, which is scheduled for April, May to 2024. And despite a difficult socioeconomic environment, some critics believe that the ruling party, the African National Congress, under the party leader, Cyril Ramaphosa, who is more popular amongst voters than the party itself, will scrape a narrow win. Higher turnouts at general election and opposition fragmentation will also increase the chances of an ANC victory. However, there's a significant probability that the ANC is being forced into an unprecedented power-sharing arrangement at the national level, generating opportunities but also increasing risks and increasing weak and fragile coalitions. What is your view on this, and how do you think this is going to impact South Africa?
Deepa, you were all focused on it. For anybody who reads the Sunday newspapers, there's a little bit about sport and there's quite a lot about politics. And as we go to whether the election's in May or whether it's in June or, or, or July. That's not going to change for some time. The challenge you've got here, and I don't want to start my answer by saying we don't know, but we don't know what's going to happen, right? The opinion polls in South Africa are pretty few. They're pretty far between. And often there are big delays from when they survey people and their views on political parties. And when we actually get the survey results, an awful lot's happened behind the scenes. What we do know kind of is this, right? Voters are very concerned about unemployment. Voters are very concerned about corruption. They're very concerned about load shedding. They're concerned about crime. They're concerned about weak governance. Those are the things that they're telling us they're most focused on. That's not a very comfortable message for the incumbent, right? Yeah. Because across all of those, what you're increasingly seeing is that the rank and file, the person on the street, is associating all of those challenges, not as much as before with the apartheid era and our goal as a country to break free of those shackles, but increasingly the focus is on the ruling party and whether they've done enough. So you've got that track record. That's a little bit difficult. You've got going into this election the difficulty that parts of the ruling party, the former president, Jacob Zuma, has announced he's going to be actively campaigning against his former comrades. And then when you look across the aisle in parliament, you've also had big changes, right? So the multi-party charter, this loose grouping of perhaps kind of center-right parties in South Africa are looking to sort of build enough momentum to sort of demonstrate to voters that a vote for the opposition isn't a vote that in some sense might be wasted. So there's an awful lot going on here. Turnout, as you mentioned, matters an awful lot, right? Yep. From more than 90% near 90% of people in the first elections in 1994 standing in a queue and making sure that they got to make their mark on a paper.
Yep.
In the last elections we had in South Africa, fewer than half of all voting age adults bothered to show up to the voting booth. So turnout matters quite critically. You'd mentioned what's going to happen here if the ANC does fall below 50%. There's so many machinations here. It's hard to know what it will mean exactly. But there's two broad potentials here, right? Away from policy, the two broad potentials that a coalition government generates sort of better unity of purpose, better consensus building, better oversight and governance. That would be fabulous. That's not been experience very often in coalition at the national level, at the municipal level or at the provincial level in South Africa. Instead, what we've seen an awful lot of is sort of endless political jockeying. What we've seen is everything needs to go to the courts. What we've seen is this is all about trying to make individual gains. And so I think there's probably quite a sensible worry right now in that we're South Africa that really needs clear direction. Where South Africa to find itself in a place where there's lots of coalitions involved, that this might not be the step forward many of us would hope for.
Okay, thank you, Jeff. I mean, just moving on to Gia. What do you think the impact would be? I mean, obviously, add to what Jeff has said, if there's anything you'd like to say on top of some of the issues that Jeff has pointed out. But what do you think the impact's going to be on the economy? What do you think this impact, the election is going to do to the South African, I wouldn't say growth story, but effectively, what do we as South Africans need to look forward to as a sort of prospective year for 2024 on the economic front?
Well, I mean, Jeff pointed out, this year's national elections, present novel uncertainty with, South Africa's macroeconomic fundamentals, much weaker than they were, before the pandemic and during the previous election. And, this is amid widespread impediments to growth. In short, I want to say, respective of the post-election permutations, whether or not the ANC gets 50% of the vote or just drop just below that, which I think are perhaps plausible scenarios. I don't really think that from an economic perspective much is going to change. I think we're going to continue to see this sluggish growth that we have been seeing, you know, post-pandemic and pre-pandemic, right? So, you know, on balance, I don't really see the, it's difficult to identify, you know, what the catalyst for growth might be. So in the event of an unlikely outcome, we'll obviously, you know, we can expect some market reaction. But, you know, ultimately, I think the overarching thing to remember here is that, you know, for a protracted period, South Africa has actually, or markets rather, have faced uncertainty. So, you know, we think back to, I think it was end of 2022, you know, with the ANC elections, you know, if you recall, all of the events that happened last year with, you know, the Lady R saga and so forth. I mean, there's just been so much uncertainty. And I think markets, you know, investors in general, you know, will sort of look forward to having and you know having an outcome, you know, with the election and say, okay, listen, this is what we see, this is what can we work with this and how do we proceed going forward. So I think that's first and foremost, this is sort of the big thing we're looking for at this stage.
Okay. No, thank you for that. I mean, you know, election aside, I mean, the main aim of the South African government from a policy perspective has always been, and I think the mantra has always been, let's boost growth and employment by implementing structural reforms that we need, you know, to tackle the widespread power shortages, transport bottlenecks, etc. And this obviously will be complicated by the domestic political challenges that we're going to see. But also, you know, there's the stringent US monetary tightening. There is a sort of weaker global black backdrop. You know, there's Europe and China that we're seeing also receding in terms of growth figures. There's the ongoing Russia-Ukraine war. You know, obviously the crisis in Gaza. You know, that also may have some implications for us in terms of further limiting the government's move room for maneuver. I mean, Jeff, what is your view? I mean, what should the government be doing to spur growth, employment, and investment against not just the local domestic backdrop, but also what's happening globally and what, you know, what we have very little control over?
Listen, I think it's difficult for governments and businesses everywhere to plan in this very uncertain environment. It's just shock after shock after shock. That said, I suspect, kind of for the wrong reasons, we've got an easier job of it here in South Africa than in almost any other country I can think of. And the reason why it's easier for us is because we're sat here with really a very large number of own goals. So when the global economy was growing very quickly in the 2010s, we were struggling. During COVID, we were struggling. Out of COVID, we were struggling. So US interest rates, maybe a little bit of a headwind, but let's be clear, if the chain has fallen off the bicycle, you don't care which way the wind is coming from. And so we've had for 15 odd years here, sort of this very negative cycle where if you look at business confidence, it's been almost 15 years, business confidence has been net positive for two quarters over nearly a decade and a half, and the quarters weren't even side by side. Well, very weak confidence generates very little investment, and very little investment generates very few jobs. And the challenges of South Africa then cycle through again. So what we have to ask ourselves are what kinds of things that are holding back that confidence and investment from generating the opportunities for South African households? Lots of different answers that sit out there. One that's at least a little bit sort of quantitative in nature. The Bureau of Economic Research, sponsored by the bank I work for, has done a survey of manufacturers every quarter for more than four decades. And it asks the manufacturers, what are the things that are holding you back? Is it you can't find the right people? Is that there's not enough demand? Is that our interest rates? Are the banks mean to you? And what we've seen now for a decade, a full decade, is that each and every quarter, the manufacturers are coming back and telling us, the most important thing that's holding them back is they don't understand the policy environment. They don't like the political climate. Well, that's got very little to do with what's happening in the Middle East, very little to do with what's happening in China and the West and others. So this is really about kind of rules of the game. And so what we hope is that either through a reform process that you're kind of pulled through not necessarily willing, but forced in that direction, as we've seen in electricity and increasingly in transport, that you start generating some rules of the game that business can take a look at and say, you know what, I understand what the next couple of years are likely to look like from a rules perspective. I think these three projects make sense. I think those two projects probably don't make sense, but away I go. And we've really, really been lacking that in a very serious way. And the example I'm using in that space is infrastructure, because it's for sure our biggest limitation. But there's probably more there. The mining sector has struggled for a set of rules. Anybody who uses water has struggled for a set of rules. All business in South Africa, I think, is signed up to the idea that we need to do better when it comes to empowerment and really breaking away from where South Africa found itself decades ago. But we don't know which direction we should be moving in. And so that kind of clarity is absolutely necessary. Whether an incoming government can deliver that or not, I'm not sure. But the people who would be investing this economy have been telling us for the last 15 years that that lack of certainty means investment can't happen. If investment can't happen, you just can't generate jobs or growth or help uplift the tens of millions of South Africans that have been left behind.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, would you agree with Jeff? I mean, do you think that, you know, policy certainty is the underlying sort of root cause of all the lack of investment we see? I mean, there's obviously a whole lot of other factors, but, you know, if people have already factored in some of those other challenges, I mean, do you agree that policy uncertainty is probably sitting at the highest point in terms of, you know, impeding future growth in South Africa?
Yeah, I do. And you make an interesting point. Look, you're looking for this business-friendly policy reform, you know, at a time when external conditions are less favorable than they were in the past. Right, and we haven't seen this before, you know, and we, as you said, you know, it's globally, geopolitical space is more uncertain. You have a slowing Chinese economy. We've seen expeditious policy monetary policy normalization in the advanced world. You know, that's another element of uncertainty, you know, heading into this year. But I think, yes, it absolutely boils down to certainty and an investment. I think, you know, we will all agree that economic growth in South Africa is constrained by low potential output, you know, which has been undermined by a lack of fixed investment and neglect of key infrastructure maintenance. You know, so while this economy, the South African economy, you know, has basically stagnated since the pandemic, you know, the past 3 or 4 years or so, debt has accumulated, you know, and real fixed investment has declined. I mean, real fixed investment per capita, you know, at the end of last year, was roughly at sort of similar levels than 2005, 2006, you know, and if you sort of build out the forecast over the next 5 years or so over the medium term, you know, you basically end up at levels, you know, pre-pandemic, end of 2019 levels. So that to me, you know, is shows that investors want certainty to come into the country and help lift the economy's potential growth. Because, you know, that's I think is what's been so unfortunate, is that the economy hasn't really been growing. We've been looking at growth rates at about 1% per annum pre-pandemic. And, you know, I said earlier, you sit and you look at the South African economy and you wonder, where is this catalyst for growth going to come from? And now, you know, we're in a year with elections, you know, politicians tend to get distracted by this. And then, you know, that business-friendly policy reform, which is so crucial, that sort of gets overlooked somewhat. And yeah, it just adds to this sort of sluggish growth picture we see for South Africa.
Okay. I mean, maybe let's just move the focus off South Africa for a second. I mean, not excluding South Africa, but you know, the World Bank issued a cautionary note highlighting that the weaknesses in the economy of Nigeria and South Africa will actually pose limitation on Sub-Saharan Africa's overall economic growth for 2024, right? And the assessment points to challenge in these key economics underscores the potential impact on the broader regional outlook. I mean, what are your views on this, Jeff? I mean, do you think that, you know, the weaknesses that we see in Nigeria and South Africa and the potential constraints that have been identified in these economies? I mean, is that bringing, you know, is that bringing the rest of the continent or the sub-Saharan continent down? And, you know, where do you agree with that view of the World Bank?
Well, some of it's just maths, right? So on a purchasing power basis, Nigeria is about a quarter of sub-Saharan Africa. South Africa is just shy of a fifth of sub-Saharan Africa. We add another large country that's been going through a difficult patch, Angola, and you get to half. It's only three out of the 44 countries. We get to half of the GDP. So if we're not growing very quickly as South Africa, we know Nigeria's had a difficult period, Angola's had some big ups and downs, then automatically when you calculate the growth rate for the region as a whole, you're going to get a number that's lower. The second bit outside of maths is just around perception, right? So whether it be institutional investors looking to access opportunities in Africa through listed equities or private equity or fixed income, or whether it be real economy investors, people looking to put sort of boots on the ground, many of your exposures are going to be in the largest economy. So if they're not working great, it's unlikely that you're going to be thinking about the opportunities that Eswatini might provide or that Malawi might provide or others. And that's a shame, right? Because we're missing in some of this, right? What we're missing in some of this is that in 2023, not an easy year for sub-Saharan Africa by any stretch of imagination. In 2023, about three quarters of the economies in sub-Saharan Africa grew at least as fast as the global average. And 2023, again, you've got, you know, the global average is pulled down by big, rich Europe and others. But if we think about emerging market and developing countries, those parts of the world that are meant to be growing fastest, about half the countries in sub-Saharan Africa are right now growing as fast or faster than that average. So it gives us a good sense of how perception and math sort of pull these things down. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't direct and important linkages, right? Big economies are typically big employers of migrant laborers, right? So here in South Africa, we have many people from Mozambique, from Malawi, from Lesotho, from Eswatini and others coming to work in South Africa. If the South African economy isn't turning over very quickly, those jobs are harder to come by. The remittances that are so important coming from a wealthy country going to other parts of the continent get less. It's a market for exports, right? Southern African countries love to export into South Africa. We're not growing, it makes it much harder. And then just the nature of our problem here around infrastructure. Let's imagine that I'm running a business in copper in Zambia. Well, South Africa is not a natural market for my copper product, but I sure need South African infrastructure to be working correctly before my business is able to produce efficiently. So absolutely, sort of when it comes to maths, when it comes to perceptions, when it comes to real linkages, the big countries aren't doing well. It just makes it harder for everybody else. But there are real successes here. Remember, more than about half the countries here in sub-Saharan Africa are growing at least as fast as the global emerging market average. So we mustn't paint everybody with the South Africa brush.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, could you maybe share some examples of regions in Southern Africa that you think have very promising outlooks for 2024 and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think Jeff talks about the maths, and just to color in that picture a bit. I mean, if we look at sort of the headline growth for Southern Africa, I think the number is growth figure for this year is something around 4%. But I mean, take that weighted average, that stands at about 1.6%. And it's interesting that that's basically, you know, in line with the long-term historical average, slightly up from the estimation we have for last year, for example. But to put this into context, if you compare to East Africa, so, you know, East Africa's weighted average growth for 2024 would be something around 5%. So compare that to 1.6% in for Southern Africa, it just shows it comes down to your regional economic anchor, which is South Africa, that is underperforming. And, you know, we've seen that the neighboring countries, so Jeff touched on these, in Eswatini, Lesotho, Namibia. I mean, these countries are you know, very dependent on the South African economy. I mean, it's basically the growth in those countries are basically a function of the South African economy. Things like SARCA receipts are crucial for some of these smaller economies. You think, for example, of Zimbabwe and Botswana, these landlocked countries trade. I mean, South Africa is a large trading partner for most of these countries. So when South Africa underperforms in terms of its logistical sector, then that obviously spills over to these other countries. I mean, like I said, they're landlocked, they're smaller, they don't, all of the goods have to move to and through South Africa, or most of them. And so, yeah, I mean, there are some bright spots that we see for this year. I think Namibia is one of those economies that a lot of interesting developments are happening in its extractive sectors, and then also like the energy space, the hydrocarbon sector in particular. Angola, we've seen a lot of, well, intent, at least from the current government, to diversify the economy. So, yeah, we shouldn't, you know, just like Jeff said, look at the South African number, which is pretty dismal, but elsewhere in Southern Africa, there are some bright spots indeed.
Great. I mean, maybe just focusing on some of the Southern African countries, and Botswana. I mean, you know, Botswana has always been one of Africa's most stable democracies, you know, with a strong political institution and a track record for peaceful elections. But, you know, the economy is very heavily dependent on the diamond mining sector, okay, which makes it vulnerable and sort of susceptible to the sort of up and down of the extractive industry, particularly on for diamonds. I mean, we know that Botswana also has an upcoming election, 2024, potentially tentatively around October. I mean, do you think that that's going to impact Botswana's economy, or you know, can we hope for a similar trajectory of sort of peaceful elections and stability that we've come to you know, that has been synonymous with sort of Botswana's history?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, you rightly point out political risk in Botswana is among the lowest on the continent. You know, the same goes for the likes of Mauritius and Namibia. I think, you know, the general expectation, or at least from our side, is that Mr. Masisi will return, you know, for a second term as president in 2024. I think that's perhaps one of the most likely or plausible outcomes, you know, as head of the Botswana Democratic Party. And this is mainly, I think, well, a large part of it comes down to the opposition that is perhaps divided and ineffectual at this stage. You know, opposition parties in Botswana have shown few signs of putting their differences aside, you know, to really mount a serious challenge. And to be honest, you know, this infighting is a perennial stumbling block across the region, to be honest. In terms of, you know, the economy, I think, you know, Botswana is also, you know, part of the very few African economies that have investment grade ratings. You know, they have low, stable inflation, favorable fiscal dynamics, relatively speaking, of course. But, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, you know, diamonds are Botswana's best friend. And they've been obviously trying to reduce the their reliance on the extractive sector. And diamond prices haven't been shining recently. And so, you know, as you point out, they are vulnerable to, you know, external price fluctuations. Botswana has been seeking to limit its reliance on imports. If you recall, the country recently you know, expanded import restrictions on various horticulture commodities. So I suppose this, you know, speaks to the landlocked country's overall ambitions to become, you know, self-sufficient. Yeah, I don't know if you want to add something to that, Jeff.
Yeah, I'd only add this. So Botswana is a relatively small country with one very oversized industry in it. So the whole country is going to wax and wane kind of with diamonds. And diamonds are a very cyclical business, and this is a particularly difficult time for the diamond business. But if you look at those parts of the economy in Botswana that aren't directly related to diamonds, sort of the non-mining part of the economy is growing about 4.5% in the third quarter. Certainly surprise to the positive side, what I would have expected. The country comes at this with very little debt in the grand scheme of things. So there's more opportunity to put money to use. And that will probably transition from being sort of surprisingly tall buildings in the middle of Gaborone to looking at other sort of plausible investments that sit there. It's also very helpful, right? Bank of Botswana has cut interest rates again quite recently. Mm-hmm. Interest rates are, the official rate there is about half of what it is in the United States. The cost of financing looks kind of achievable. I guess if we wanted to list risk, it wouldn't necessarily be on the political angle. We'd be watching a little bit, not just Botswana, of course, but for El Nino and what it means for a country that tends to be quite water scarce, right? So there's a certain challenge that sits there.
I mean, maybe, you know, just a little focus on Angola for a second. Angola has been, you know, the intention, at least for Angola, is known to diversify its economy, but that, you know, their short-term emphasis will always be maximizing the country's oil wealth. And that's always been the sort of driver or the catalyst for longer-term development. Now, the National Development Plan that they've put together, which is, you know, which runs from 2023 to 2027, aims to use oil earnings while prices are high to fund social spending and infrastructure development and to repay a lot of the public debt. I mean, what are your views on this? I mean, you know, either speaker, what are your views on this? Do you think this is actually going to work? I mean, do you think that they're moving in the right direction? Is that sort of the, would you say that that is the sensible way of trying to grow and develop the country?
Well, I think just as an opening comment, you know, $75-$80 a barrel isn't as high as it once felt. So you've got the price challenge, and then Angola's got a volume challenge, right? If you look at daily production levels, they've sort of been stuck at this barely more than 1 million barrels a day. We know that there's lots of exciting opportunities, whether it be in traditional oil or whether it be in gas, but they require huge investments and time. And so it's no surprise to me that you've seen a currency under considerable pressure right now. That's making all sorts of other things more difficult, right? If you want to diversify an economy, well, you're going to need to be able to access business financing at rates that make sense in order to take the opportunity of big domestic market or perhaps look at opportunities that the Continental African Free Trade Agreement will give you as well. Well, that does not easily describe the financing environment in Angola today, and it's frankly probably unlikely to describe it any time soon. So difficult, right? Difficult starting point for a very resource-rich country and a government, right, that I think really gets it, right? If you spend any time at investment forums and others, these are fantastic delegations from Angola that are absolutely focused on telling making the story clear to people, understanding what's different from before, that Angola's open for business. And so I feel quite positive, sort of medium and long term, of where the Angolans will find themselves. Oil $20 a barrel higher would just make that a little bit easier this year and next year.
Any further comments?
Just to add to that, I think I agree with what Jeff said. I think we're also seeing intent, you know, from the current administration to diversify the economy. And this is evidenced by, for example, increased gas production and also infrastructure projects. So, for example, you know, gas exports have grown from, I think, something like 1.7% to under 2% of total exports in 2016 to 11% over the past 2 years. And then over that same period, we've seen that oil's share of exports have actually come down. So, you know, these trends, I want to say, underscore, you know, the increased role that natural gas production can play to help stabilize the petroleum sector. As crude oil production is quite variable in Angola, and also in prices have been very volatile, as we've seen last year. But also one important point is the Lobito corridor, which is an example of Angola's government, the government's eagerness for private foreign capital investment, and as I said, to diversify the economy away from oil, and also to reduce the country's reliance on China for investment. On the reciprocal side, the Lobito corridor, in a way presents opportunity for the US and the EU to advance their influence in Africa, and also it helps the country to diversify so their critical minerals supply chain. But having said that, I think if we look at Angola is quite highly corrupt in terms of the Transparency International corruption perception index. I think if you look at that index, it shows that there has been improvement, and I think the Lorenzo administration is something that they focused on quite a bit, and as I said, there have been positive signs. I think if this Lobito corridor project in a way could be a litmus test to prove if the Lorenzo anti-corruption drive is genuine or merely just a replacement of the old guard. So I think Angola is definitely one of those economies that are worth keeping an eye on in the near term.
Fantastic. Okay, well, it looks like we're running out of time, and I do want to pose some of the questions from our audience to you before we close off. I obviously also wanted to hear your views on Zambia and Eswatini, but let's just move on to some of the questions that have been posed by our audience and Jeff. Whoever wants to answer, please do so. So the first question we have is that with the current energy crisis in South Africa, how do guests see the energy evolution in South Africa and the SADC region? And will renewables make our products and services more competitive? Views on the Southern African power pool, its power mix, and contribution of member states. Who wants to go for that one?
You can go, Jeff.
I think there's many parts to that question. That's an entire discussion on itself. I think the bit of that that's interesting most to me was this query about whether renewables are going to make our products and services more competitive. And there's two aspects to that, right? One is right now we have an absolute lack of electricity, and it's very hard to be competitive when you can't make the product in the first place. But maybe the more thoughtful part of the discussion is around the carbon border adjustment mechanism that the European Union is implementing, and not too far from now, right? That's an implementation that's covering only a few industries to start with, but it's going to be more industries going forward. It's going to look to actively tax imports from countries that are very carbon intensive. Well, if we think about our automotive sector here in South Africa and our ability to export into what's traditionally been our biggest markets, that's going to start becoming very difficult very quickly if we're not able to green our energy in a significant way and fairly fast. So renewables are going to be an absolutely critical part of South Africa maintaining competitive access to our traditional markets. And I don't think there's any sort of just transition discussion to be had in that space. Just transition matters in a lot of ways, but the Europeans don't want to know about it if you want access to their market. So I think that that's really important. And then within that, we get the same discussion in South Africa that you have everywhere else. Renewables are wonderful, but what do you do at night? Renewables are wonderful, but what do you do on those days when it is not windy and it is not, and what do you do when you have a renewable system that overtaxes the transmission grid? Because it's sunny in the Northern Cape, there's not enough transmission to get that to where the factories are in Gauteng. So those aren't uniquely South African problems, but they're important. Our renewables are coming online. We need them more than almost anyone else because of our lack of electricity. But let's be clear, it's not just our lack. The Europeans and others are going to force our hand. Everyone who wishes to export is going to need to get much greener very quickly.
Maybe just moving on to, we've got do you want to add anything on that one?
I just want to say, I mean, I think this energy transition to renewable comes at a time where we see numerous African, and it's not just South Africa, African economies facing insufficient electricity supply, or, you know, a lack of reliable electricity. I mean, I think Kenya had a number of blackouts last year. I think Nigeria also, for example, experienced a blackout in 2023. And so, you know, as Jeff says, you know, the Europeans aren't going to wait for Africa. And this and a just transition is important. I think it's very important in the African context, but it's crucial. Let me put it this way: African countries are, as I said, you know, they're struggling with electricity supply issues, and now they have to transition. And ultimately, this disadvantages African economies to the point where these economies can't really fully industrialize like we've seen in Europe and elsewhere. So it's a very, the timing, I want to say, of it all is quite unfortunate. But I mean, it's the reality, and that's why it's so crucial that sort of everybody pulls in the right direction or in the same direction in on this topic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I just want to give, I want to be able to see if we can answer as many of the audience questions as possible. So apologies if I'm cutting you a bit short there. We got a question on Zambia. In fact, there's quite a bit of keenness on actually understanding the perspective on Zambia and on ESA20. Maybe I'll take this question. Zambia is a rich critical is rich in critical minerals that are essential to energy transition. How are countries like Zambia, or how can countries like Zambia do to attract more investors in their sectors?
So Zambia is engaged in quite a lengthy debt restructuring process right now. And so long as that debt restructuring process isn't concluded, it makes it difficult for many types of investors to put fresh money into Zambia. And the lack of that fresh money coming in leaves the currency under pressure. Currency under pressure is higher domestic interest rates. It's more difficult for the lives of all Zambians. So you've got sort of a very specific thing here that needs to come to its conclusion. And I'm sort of, I think, quite confident that we're not going to be having at least a debt restructuring discussion about Zambia in 2025 when we have another Southern Africa call. The second bit about this, though, is it's not just enough that you have all of the mineral resources that the rest of the world wants. You need to have a regulatory environment that leaves investors feeling comfortable that the 30-year investment they need to make in order to pull the copper out of the ground, this is a sensible place to do it. We know that under the previous administration, that was very difficult for companies to feel comfortable about. Tax regime and others constantly changed. The sense is that this government is a little bit easier for those companies to work with, but there's a, you know, you have a history of distrust. And then the third bit is you need the infrastructure. I mean, for anyone who has spent time on the Zambia-Zimbabwe border, right? That bridge, every 15, 20 minutes comes a convoy of copper trucks, right? Copper is a bulk commodity. It shouldn't be on trucks. It then spends better part of a day getting through Zim, enters here into South Africa to make its way to a port. How are you going to compete with the Chileans in terms of costs for copper production if you're having to spend kind of better part of 4 or 5 days on trucks trying to get this to a port? Then in any event is very congested and the trucks go back empty. So there's lots of additional things. It's not just that you have the resource, right? But you got to have an environment that's conducive to investment. And then you got to have the infrastructure to get the darn stuff out so that to use sort of the equity research language, you aren't to the right of the cost curve, right? Price of copper dips a little bit. You don't want to be the mines that have to shut first. You need to get your costs much lower. And Zambia's probably still got a fair bit of work to do in that space. But as I say, the administration, from what I see, the current administration is certainly eyes wide open around this. And is making more positive moves than the previous administration.
Yeah, I think maybe we'll take one last question. You know, if we've got time for that, I'm just looking at our organizers to see if we're okay to do one more question. Okay, this is focused on Botswana. The government of Botswana has launched programs to assist farmers at different levels of scales. The scarcity of water affects several industries. How would it be possible to increase, I'm assuming water between satellite countries to bring in water stores for arable land? Any thoughts?
Very specific question on the water industry.
I mean, I suppose the challenge you've got in is twofold. One, as an economist, we always like to pretend that we're expert on everything. I'm far from an expert on water affairs, but Botswana isn't just landlocked. You have Namibia as a border. Namibia is far from water rich. In South Africa, where I sit, the vast majority of the water I consume comes from Lesotho. So we are far from water rich here. We know that the western parts of Zimbabwe have recently faced a very significant drought and do so with increasing frequency. And so I suppose what you're looking for is north, but it certainly isn't the case. I guess the point I'm making, it isn't the case that much of Southern Africa is water rich. All of us are facing some version of water scarcity. And if you look at the climate science that's been done specifically around Southern Africa, and you fast forward one or two decades, it really is very, very challenging, the environment that we're going to find ourselves in. In terms of peak temps, in terms of crops that will grow, in terms of the variability and average precipitation we're expecting, all of those indicators are flashing very much red. So it's not just a Botswana challenge, I suppose, and it's a very difficult challenge.
Yeah, any thoughts that you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think, Jeff touched on an important point. It does not, adverse weather doesn't really just affect, things like agriculture and food security. It can also impact electricity supply in Southern Africa. I mean, if you look, for example, at Zimbabwe and Zambia, those countries where economies are perhaps over-reliant on hydroelectricity generated from the Kariba Dam. I looked, recently the water levels of the Kariba Dam are up slightly from last year, albeit very low. And this just adds to, the variability in electricity supply, which ultimately undermines the economic performance of these, two economies. And as we've said earlier, the extractive sectors are very important for economic drivers for most Southern African economies. So, I mean, this is multifaceted, to be honest. And it is... We are in a time where we are facing El Nino, and this definitely is a salient risk, I think, for a number of Southern African countries this year.
Okay, great. I think that's all that we've got. A couple of more questions, but I'm not sure we have the time to go through all of them. I'd like to really, sorry, Jeff, you wanted to say something. Oh, no. I'd like to thank both our speakers for the enlightening conversation and the insights. Let's hope that, despite the economic predictions that we heard today, that we do have a stronger year and we do see some progress from an infrastructure development and an economic perspective in Southern Africa. It's really important for all our economies and for the people in our economies that we continue to strive for growth. I really want to thank both Jeff and for sharing their views and their perspectives today. And I'm going to hand over to Chantel to do the closing. Thank you.
Thank you, Deepa, and to our lovely panelists. This webinar was definitely thought-provoking, leaving us some takeaways to weave into our planning for the year ahead. I look forward to actually seeing a lot of you, hopefully, on 5 February in the sunny, beautiful Cape Town for our Invest Africa Mining in Durban series to continue this discussion and some of the questions that we didn't quite get to because there were quite a number of them. Just a quick reminder that this recording is also going to be available to share with your colleagues and other interested parties. So I think there's not much left to say than to join us also on Wednesday for our Invest Africa Outlook for North Africa. So that brings this Invest Africa Outlook for Southern Africa 2024 to a close. Thank you to everyone for joining, and goodbye until next time.